So we'll start with a concept that maybe is in some ways the key concept in the book, or one of them at least, the carceral state. So what is the carceral state exactly?
So this is kind of the question. I think historians and social scientists, we all have different definitions of what the carceral state is. The formal definition is that it's the kind of law enforcement officers who kind of police the streets and help maintain order. It's the court marshals and the lawyers and the probation and parole officers and, of course, correctional officials. So it's kind of all of the formal institutions of the criminal justice system. But the way that I think about the carceral state has been, and I don't know if you got a sense of this from the book, but has been deeply kind of informed by Foucault's idea of the carceral, which is a carceral continuum or carceral network that stretches from social welfare programs to social control programs to crime control programs to law enforcement. So part of what I'm trying to show, and I'm trying to get us to expand our definitions of the carceral state to think about social programs that are operating in low-income urban communities, beginning with the kind of first federal intervention in low-income urban areas with the Kennedy administration and lasting to today, and the ways in which these social welfare programs also impose various forms of supervision and surveillance, and often this is something that Foucault talks about too, that people who come into contact with these various social welfare programs of the state eventually kind of end up in prison. So the kind of formal definition is more, I don't want to say limited, but it's a more traditional view of kind of just the institutions of criminal justice and law enforcement, whereas I see it as at least the way it develops in the late 20th century over the last 50 years as being kind of this network that expands between social welfare programs and law enforcement. So
tied up with that, is there a claim that you can't write, in some sense, the political history of the United States over the last 50 years, or at least, like, you know, the history of the state of the United States without taking into account prisons, or, like, putting prisons at the center of the story?
Yes, I would definitely agree with that. And I think that Heather Thompson, who was one of the first historians to really break the problem of mass incarceration in the late 20th century into the discipline of history, that's one of her central arguments, that if we really want to understand the kind of transformation of liberalism in the late 20th century and the ways in which the American state works, we have to kind of rethink our previous assumptions and put crime control and law enforcement kind of front and center of what the state has become. And especially from the perspective of low-income Americans, the carceral state, law enforcement, criminal justice institutions are kind of the last, and police are the last public institutions standing in many of these communities. So if that is kind of the foremost representation of the state, then we must, I think, rethink the way that we see the state and its ties to mass incarceration and criminalization.
So what is there anything distinctive about the place of the United States in this? We know that, like, every country has prisons, potentially every country has a carceral state. What makes the United States different, if anything?
So if you look at, if I had my, like, my PowerPoint that I use, you can see, like, and I'm sure some of you have probably seen them, because obviously or you care about these issues because you're here. So the U.S. incarceration rate is, like, way up here, and then everywhere else is kind of, like, way down. We incarcerate, you've probably heard this before, you know, 5% of the world's population, 25% of the world's prisoners. We are the largest incarcerator in the world. If you look at black male incarceration rates, they also, just looking at black Americans, the incarceration rate for black males is, like, still higher than that of Russia. I mean, it's really, really kind of out of control. But it's not as if our prison system is uniquely inhumane. There are other horrible prison systems around the world. It's just that the rate in which we punish, and I think the rate in which a lot of other nations in the Western Hemisphere punish and who ends up getting punished is very much rooted in legacies of enslavement in the United States and the Caribbean. So I think that shapes our punitiveness and who we punish and why and for how long.
But it's also, as you pointed out, like the making of the contemporary American carceral state is a very recent phenomenon, and as you argue in the book, it's a thoroughly bipartisan one.
Mm-hmm.
We're so used to thinking now, and I guess, by the way, I should thank you all for deciding to take refuge from the Republican National Convention.
Yeah, I know that was a competition tonight.
But during convention season, we're so used to thinking of the parties as locked in this perpetual war.
Yeah.
How did they come together to create this thing, this carceral state?
So the issue, the politics, the issue of crime control is the issue, the only issue in the domestic issue in the late 20th century where liberal and conservative interests were thoroughly intertwined. It's basically the only thing that liberals and conservatives have been able to agree on. And so I argue that, you know, when I came to this project, and I should say part of, I think, why the project was so exciting within our department, we're both trained as historians, is that historians weren't really asking these questions before. It was mostly under the domain of sociologists and political scientists. And the arguments were, especially coming from the kind of political science camp, Vesta Weaver probably being one of the exceptions, was that, you know, this was kind of an electoral tool, that it was the brainchild of the Reagan administration, that it came out of the Republican Party. And when we step back, we see that actually this is mass incarceration, the criminalization of low-income urban Americans is really the outcome of sets of decisions that policymakers made, and that the kind of origins of the modern carceral state, the federal intervention, begins not in the Reagan 80s, but begins at the height of progressive social change in the U.S. and the Civil Rights Revolution with Lyndon Johnson. Johnson initiates this program as kind of part of his Great Society, as a complement to the War on Poverty. He sees warring on poverty and warring on crime as kind of the same thing. And what I argued in the book and what I discovered after spending a great deal of time in the Johnson archives is that his own, and this stems also from the Kennedy administration, the kind of the limited view, their own racism about the root causes of poverty, influenced and informed very much by social scientists like Daniel Patrick Moynihan, who argues that that black poverty is the product of black cultural pathology, so the behavior patterns, and not kind of larger socioeconomic issues. So Johnson kind of offers this carrot and the stick. We'll initiate job training programs and equal opportunity programs under the War on Poverty to kind of teach to teach disadvantaged Americans how to become productive, and this is policymakers' language, citizens. And as the kind of other aspects of the symptoms of that poverty manifest through crime, we'll initiate this national law enforcement intervention and put more police on the streets to kind of deal with that immediate impact. Remember that the federal government had not involved itself in state and local law enforcement for the previous 200 years of U.S. history. So suddenly in 1965, a week before Johnson sends the Voting Rights Act to Congress, he begins the first national investment in urban police forces. This, you know, it's kind of part of our lives now. We're used to these militarized and kind of ubiquitous police force, especially in urban areas, but this is really coming out of this period.
Mm-hmm. And one of the things I love about this book is that, so it's a political history, so you're examining policymaking at the highest level.
Mm-hmm.
It's a social history, so you're like looking at what these policies look like when they're on the ground. But it's also an intellectual history, and you got
mm-hmm.
to this when you're talking about cultural pathology.
Mm-hmm.
You believe that there's like a strong role for these arguments and like framing how policy is made.
Mm-hmm.
So can you talk a little bit more about how cultural pathology migrates from being like
mm-hmm.
an academic conceit and becomes,
mm-hmm.
you know, some ideas like are born in the academy, they live there and then they die.
Mm-hmm.
Others have a career in the outside world. Why did this one
mm-hmm.
travel so well?
Because I think so in part by arguing that black poverty is a pathological problem, it really kind of removes national policymakers from launching a structural war on poverty, because they say, you know, we don't need to do a fundamental job creation program for low-income Americans. We can deal with these problems simply by offering them job training programs, even if we don't necessarily have jobs afterwards. We can give skill building workshops, homemaking workshops to single black mothers, etc. And so it means that the war on poverty, you know, even though the Economic Opportunity Act of 64 is this unprecedented $1 billion federal investment in community action programs. It doesn't necessarily require a major, major transformation of American institutions in the way that if we understand poverty as being the product of systematic inequality and unemployment and failing schools and deteriorating housing and the kind of long-term legacy of oppression in America, that requires a greater commitment on the part of federal policymakers that consistently, I mean, Johnson and beyond, and perhaps still today, they're unwilling to really make.
Do you think that this commitment was sincerely felt, that they really believed in this cultural pathology? Or is it a case of like grasping, it's a convenient excuse for not undertaking these structural reforms that for other reasons?
Yeah, I think that Johnson and other liberal policymakers really did kind of cling to cultural pathology. I think part of what the book is trying to get us to wrestle with is that there are racist underpinnings within American liberalism, and that liberal policymakers can be racist too. They also create policies under a set of racist assumptions. And even though Johnson is, you know, we get landmark civil rights legislation during his administration and the war on poverty, and those are good things, they're still limited. The thing is, the difference between Johnson and Nixon is that Johnson is really kind of committed to, I mean, he sees this because he does believe that it's black culture that causes poverty. He sees this as an effort to end poverty, just like he hopes the war on crime will stop crime. This is this is something that I think is really important to Johnson and Kennedy. When we get to Nixon, those intentions aren't necessarily there, and so crime is not seen as something, and social problems are not something that should be solved. It's not the federal government's responsibility to solve these problems. This is something that, you know, this is informed by social scientists who kind of got their policy start in the Johnson administration, like James Q. Wilson and Moynihan, who increasingly kind of shifts over to the right, and Edward Banfield, and that the government really, the government's responsibility is to manage these problems instead of trying to solve them. And so we begin to get even more disinvestment from social welfare programs.
It seems, too, that this notion of cultural pathology links up with another really important element in the story, which is the birth of crime statistics, or sort of like modern sophisticated crime statistics. Mm-hmm. And you might think that, oh, God, statistics, like, whatever, that's boring. But in your argument, both, like, they're very, very important for the politics of how this is shaped, and they're also completely unreliable. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about that dynamic?
Yeah, so in many ways, I think this story picks up the work of Khalil Muhammad, who wrote this fantastic book called The Condemnation of Blackness that looks at the kind of the use of statistics following emancipation to kind of justify surveillance and criminalization and incarceration of newly freed people from, you know, the 1870s, 1880s through the early 20th century. He says that, or Khalil's term is that there's a statistical discourse about black crime that has really kind of shaped the ways in which we talk about race and shaped policy choices. And so I see that statistical discourse being taken up once again in the 60s. So as the Johnson administration, as the federal government is beginning to invest in the modernization of the carceral state, American law enforcement, they're also investing millions of dollars into new research initiatives that are primarily focused. Well, so one, they're forcing states to report crime in ways that they hadn't before. The FBI had started to measure, the uniform crime rate starts in the 30s, but not all states and local governments had the capacity to regularly report their crime statistics. The federal government ensures that they do that, and so for the course of the 20th century, more and more do. In order to receive these federal grants, state and local governments have to report crime figures, and so there's a new kind of data collection monster that even the requirements for these grants unearth. So we get the rise of computerized fingerprinting systems, we get computerized criminal justice data banks in the late 60s, early 70s as a result of these policies, and so it's much easier to keep track of who's in the criminal justice system, and it fuels this data gathering monster. So there's that piece of it. But many of the studies that the federal government support through the Law Enforcement Assistance Administration, which is essentially the grant-making arm of the of the Department of Justice and the agency that prosecutes the war on crime. They fund and tend to privilege studies that look at crime in low-income urban neighborhoods of color. So when you're focusing energy and resources on these neighborhoods and these problems, that shapes how you talk about the issue and problem and your sense of the problem. If you're not measuring juvenile delinquency in suburban areas and you're only measuring juvenile delinquency, for instance, in New York City, that's going to shape your perception of delinquency and how your response is to delinquency. Something else I was going to say, but maybe it'll come back in something else.
Okay, I mean, you say it becomes like a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Yes, it's a self-fulfilling prophecy.
It's just because it's like, oh, your like programs become like designed about around this, and like they start targeting it, so you just can't see anything. I think someone says at one point that policymakers use statistics like they use a lamppost for support, not illumination.
Yes, that's a great quote. It's one of my favorites.
Well, and actually, speaking of great quotes, like one of the amazing things about this book, and I think it's true of a lot of great works of history, is that, I mean, you're talking about this like tragic subject, so lots of it is like deeply, deeply sad, but it's often also like really, really funny because you're talking about like these policymakers who are just saying things that, I mean, I hope that they sounded crazy at the time, but in retrospect, it's just like batshit loony. So you have someone like J. Edgar Hoover is like, I think he's in the Oval Office saying, or he's giving this report saying, the problem with cities right now, we I guess they didn't have the term super predators yet.
Yeah.
But it's like there's this like gang of super predators, and there's 7 to 9 year old black kids who are just like drunk all the time, and like they just can't be stopped.
Right.
And you have, and speaking to the point about statistics, there's someone who says, it's one of Nixon's policy guys.
The crime problem's more apparent than real.
No, it might be that guy, but he says like they have this big rollout, fancy announcement, like, we are going to reduce crime in the United States by 20%.
Yeah.
And they're like, how'd you pick that number? I just made it up.
Yep.
Like, you would like, did your perspective of how federal policymaking is made, did that change after this? Like, what was it like to find that stuff in the archives?
What was great about visiting the different, so I visited all of the White House Central Files of every administration from Kennedy to Reagan, and especially I would like kind of immerse myself there, and time would fly by, and you get used to kind of the culture of the administrations, and the way that the culture of the administrations came through was really exciting to me. For instance, Johnson was very, reading that, I mean, I didn't write about this in the book, but it shapes my argument and my view of the administrations. Johnson was very proud of his legislative accomplishments, and rightly so, and he was very careful about how historians would write about him and remember him, so he made it very easy. I don't know if anybody's, have you been in the Johnson archive? So he made it very easy for historians to write from his, because he made these extensive legislative books that have all the documents kind of lined up. He was just conscious about how he would be remembered, and I appreciated that. It kind of reflects his, even though I don't agree with all of his policy choices, but it reflects his respect for history, his awareness of the historic role of his administration, and his care for the nation.
And Richard Nixon was like, let me put all my racist thoughts into a microphone.
Yeah. Nixon administration was like a frat house. Like, my sense of Nixon was really that they had a lot of really young staff. They would kind of make fun of each other and have little inside jokes in their memos, and it really felt like he ran it like a frat house. But like a really
bad frat house. I feel like he has this weird Kennedy envy, so they're always trying to like imitate the cool kids. Like they think this is what they should be doing, but they can't pull it off. Like,
maybe. And they kind of overstate things, and they don't really know what they're talking about. But Reagan was also like Nixon, very, very ideologically driven. So they just wanted to get through what they wanted to get through, and that was that. And screw your enemies. I mean, it was a crony system that was that kind of the tone of it. But I also have a soft spot for Nixon because I think in a way that I didn't feel in the other administrations, he respected intellectuals, and he was thoughtful in a way. And then Ford and Carter are what I imagine like Obama. They weighed, also easy to write from as a historian, because they weighed all sides of like what the possible outcomes of if they did this or that, what would happen, and who would say what, and who the opposition was, and so they thought and they debated every single policy initiative or move they made. So that was interesting. And Reagan had incredibly intelligent people around him, and was also very, very ideologically driven. They knew what they wanted to accomplish, and they got it done for the most part. So that it's kind of the most effective administration.
So what was the long-range master plan?
Oh, gosh. Yeah, so this is, I think, one of the most important findings of the book. So in 1970, Nixon orders Attorney General John Mitchell to devise a 10-year long-range master plan for American corrections. And basically, so we, you know, again, this is, we think about the prison explosion and prison construction happening in the 80s, 90s. Nixon says, we're going to spend $500 million to, which is, I think, like $1.5 or $2 billion in today's dollars, to revitalize the federal system, and this is going to be a model for states. They started making prison population projections based on, again, this is where, like, the racism comes in, but not necessarily in an obvious way. They project for prison populations based on the Kerner Commission and the Crime Commission's projections. These are task forces that Johnson called in the 60s, of what the black youth population would be. So that was part of what they used. They also used, in the mid-70s, as the long-range plan was unfolding, the Congressional Research Service made all these, or found these correlations between unemployment and incarceration. So instead of supporting programs that might have dealt with issues of unemployment and issues stemming from unemployment, they use these congressional figures and this correlation that's established to further project for prison populations. Okay, like, unemployment's going up, unemployment of black men's going up, so we need to build more prisons. I think that's really important. When I came across this document in the Nixon archives, I didn't know quite what to do with it. It's really eerie because you see the prison population is 200,000 or so in 1970, and you see that there's a huge spike that policymakers are projecting that it's going to go up by to, I think, about 500,000. That was their original projection by 1980. And then eventually the goals of this plan, which involve the construction of maximum security facilities, so this is kind of the origins of Supermax and this idea that an increasing shift within the Bureau of Prisons, that prison is not necessarily, like, there's no point in really devoting resources towards rehabilitative programs. Really, we need, prison management needs to be about how to make prisons work for new populations that are going to be entering the prison system for very, very long terms. So by 1980, the long-range plan unfolds, the federal government begins to give states essentially 75% off beginning in 1970 for prison construction, and the prison population transitions from being majority white to being majority black and Latino sometime around 1975. So this long-range plan is important because the idea is that mass incarceration is something that policymakers didn't anticipate or plan for, that it's something that just kind of happened, and that it was a response to crime and a response to violence and response to changing birth rates. But this was a document where policymakers, the highest level, are actually anticipating that the prison population is going to explode. And, you know, I'm not a quantitative researcher, so it's hard for me to get my mind around how you, and the similar with crime projections, they project for crime all the time too. How can you predict what a prison population is going to be? It just doesn't make sense to me. And it's related to the predictive policing, you know, that's also going on, proactive policing, community policing, that's beginning in this period too.
So another concept that emerges a little bit earlier and is sort of, it navigates around similar circles but has different consequences. If anything, unlike the long-range master plan, it's a case study in unintended consequences, is a maximum feasible participation, mm-hmm. which sounds mm-hmm. like it couldn't be anything more bureaucratic in the mm-hmm. world, but becomes this, like, intense flashpoint of controversy. Mm-hmm. Can you explain what that was?
Yeah, and I think actually maximum feasible participation is the best aspect of the war on poverty and what we need to kind of come back to now. It was basically the most radical aspect of the legislation of the Economic Opportunity Act, which is basically that the federal government should give, that communities can better respond to their own problems than policymakers. And so these war on poverty grants, called community action programs, should go directly to local organizations so that they can kind of solve their own problems on their own terms. This was by far, as I said, the most kind of radical, I think, transformative notion. And people using under this principle did amazing, community groups did phenomenal things. State and local officials, particularly local officials, really disliked the principle of maximum feasible participation because they thought that the federal government was enabling these kind of marginalized and isolated communities to get too much power. They were unwilling to cede their power again, unwilling to really transform things. So people charged that community action programs, the Office of Economic Opportunity, which ran the program, essentially like a voter drive for the Democratic Party, that they were doing things like organizing sit-ins against unresponsive landlords and, you know, basic African American studies curriculums in public schools, things like that. And mayors did not want these community organizations to be operating with public money without kind of more oversight from municipal officials. So the kind of golden age of maximum feasible participation lasts from 64, when the legislation is enacted, until really the fall of 65, when Congress amends the legislation. This is in the aftermath of the Watts uprising of August 65, which many policymakers take as proof that the war on poverty isn't working, even though it hadn't even been programs had just started running nationwide. But that was kind of used as fuel to kind of take some of the autonomy away from these grassroots organizations. And so municipal officials and police officers in some cases took on an increasing role in the ways in which these funds would be allocated. And eventually, by the end of the war on poverty, through programs like Model Cities, community action becomes institutionalized. And so it's not even this kind of model where the federal government is funding local groups directly. Mm-hmm. So that was just kind of a very brief moment, but a promising one, and I think it sets an important precedent for us now.
Yeah, and so like the specter of like roads not taken is sort of always mm-hmm. here in this book, and it seems like the combination of a radicalization of the maximum feasible participation impulse combined with like real structural reform, that's what mm-hmm. it seems like you invest the most hope in.
Yeah.
But when I was reading the book, I was wondering sort of how people of different politics would respond to it.
Yeah.
And so one sort of just like the liberal who wants to defend what the home team was up to during mm-hmm. this period, I imagine a defense would go something along the lines of like, as you know, they're totally on board with the structural reform project, I can see how this would have worked, but it just politically wasn't on the cards in the mm-hmm. 1960s or 1970s. What do you make of that argument? And just as like a for example,
yeah.
So like you mentioned that 1968 was like a squeaker of an election, right?
Yeah.
Like Nixon just barely beats out Humphrey. So it's like, oh, mm-hmm. like from one perspective, it might seem like the two were neck and neck. But of course, it's only a squeaker because George Wallace is sopping up like 14% of the vote or whatever. So when you add the Nixon total to the Wallace total, suddenly it makes the context seem very different.
Mm-hmm. I think that there was, I think that, and you know, in some ways, it's similar to the moment that we're experiencing now. Mm-hmm. How do we frame as a society and respond to mass protests and in some cases collective violence? I think that a lot of, and consistently, some of the most, even within kind of the rehabilitation programs and the community-based crime control programs that were implemented in the 60s and 70s, a lot of these really promising programs aren't given a chance mm-hmm. to work, even though they tend to be more cost-effective. People have used the fiscal argument in terms of rethinking mass incarceration, and I think that's part of the reason why even though they're still fighting about the Fair Sentencing Act in Congress, we're beginning to see these kind of reforms, and I do believe that, depending on who's president, we will be entering into a decarceration moment. But I think there's a lack of, again, this kind of lack of real commitment to the long-term patience that's required for these kind of structural changes to take place. And again, you know, what's at the heart of it so many times is this kind of unwillingness to fully dismantle the racial hierarchies that have defined the U.S. historically. And I think, you know, a lot of times racism gets in the way of really meaningful change.
So if, like, my caricatured liberal is just out to defend poor Hubert and mm-hmm. Lyndon, I had like a conservative reading that was bouncing around too, which would say that, and I could actually imagine like a lot of conservative readers like really enjoying a lot of this book, sort of disagreeing with the conclusion, because in a way you could say that what this book tells, sort of with this book we have a story of three great failures amid 20th century liberalism. There are three wars that LBJ declares in his administration. One is a war in Vietnam, the other is a war on poverty, and the other is a war on crime. Mm-hmm. All three are disasters. And there's a sense in which it's like you're asking, you provide this a really compelling recreation of how exactly sort of the intersection of the war on poverty and the war on crime like led both of them to fail. But in a way, sort of you're calling for, you're showing how this sort of like more narrow targeted reform, the government could even pull that off. And you're holding out the possibility of like some like massive reconstruction of American society. Yeah. Do you think the American state, just like people, the same people who are like, yeah, I just picked 20% because it sounded nice, did they have the capacity to pull off something like that?
I don't know if Nixon did or the commitment. I mean, he's the one who did. I think that communities do though. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that if that principle had been widely implemented, accompanied by a job creation program and accompanied by a Marshall Plan, as the Kerner Commission suggested, for American cities, we could have really seen change. And the thing is, it could have been done in the sense that we don't get a job creation program for low-income urban Americans, but we do, during this period, but we do get a job creation program for police officers. Part of this investment is also kind of the major expansion of police training programs. Local law enforcement departments are getting millions in federal grants to hire new people. So there are investments in certain, and of course, the kind of growing prison industry and law enforcement industry that has really, in many communities, been a Band-Aid for the impact of deindustrialization and the decline of domestic manufacturing. So I think so much of it has to do with the ways in which problems are framed, the consistent response to socioeconomic issues with punitive programs, and this real unwillingness and a resistance to putting the resources necessary, not only to actually give marginalized and vulnerable communities equality of outcome, but also to empower them to have license and control and self-determination over the institutions that they interact with on an everyday basis.
So if my stereotypical liberal is really concerned about politics and my stereotypical conservative is really concerned about state capacity, my stereotypical radical thinks that this is all really just about capitalism. And like what you're showing is just like the limitations of any sort of reformist project without a broader capitalist transformation. What would you have to say to that stereotype?
Say they have a point. I say that, you know, I think, again, you know, and especially if we think about the ways in which capitalism and racism are synonymous, mm-hmm. I really see racism and classism, but in the ways in which these programs actually played out, you know, especially in the 70s and 80s, racism really, really, I think, structures domestic policy and the kind of principle that this is, that poverty is pathological among Black Americans, and that by the 70s, this kind of rising view that crime is somehow innate among low-income Black Americans, I think has been an important and guiding domestic policy principle. So, you know, if for this truly, truly to be dismantled, I think that we need to dismantle racism, but also commit to, really, really commit to the principle of equality. And I don't think that has only kind of come up for brief moment, been an important part of our policies for brief moments, 1865 and 1965, and then we go back to liberty being the kind of policy path.
So going from like the really macro to the really micro, I mentioned earlier that one of the best parts of the book is that you get a great sense of what these initiatives look like on the ground. And to me, nothing better captures one stage of this process than the story of Angelo Lasagna and PFF Inc. Could you tell me about him?
Yes. So this is actually one of my favorite parts of the book too. You're bringing out all the good stories, Tim.
No, thanks, there's so many others that are not discussed. You must
buy. Thanks for reading it so carefully. So I just mentioned, you know, the idea of innate criminality, And by the mid-70s, the strategy for the war on crime is essentially, okay, we need to create opportunities to make mass arrests in low-income urban communities because incarceration, and remember, the long-range master plan is unfolding and prisons are being constructed at historic rates during this period. Incarceration is a sound crime deterrent, and crime is really a problem among a specific population. So if we can identify that population and stop them from committing crime or before they go, stop them committing petty crime before they go on to commit more violent crime and put them in prison, we will deal with this crime problem. That was their kind of way in which the Ford administration, the Nixon administration, how they sought to manage the crime problem. So what begins to happen is what I call the creation of crime itself. Essentially, in D.C., the federal government begins to fund these sting operations. You might have heard of some of them, like the Abscam scandal, which is the American Hustle film. That's one. The very first one was this fake mafia operation involving Washington, D.C. police officers, federal agents, and Department of Justice officials, where they rented this unheated warehouse on the northeast side of D.C., and they essentially, they're dressed in what they think would be Italian mafia wear. Remember, The Godfather had recently been released. They were influenced by The Godfather. They speak in fake Italian accents, and they start trying to recruit people to go out and steal stolen goods and then bring them to the warehouse and fence them. So they essentially created a market, a constant market for black petty thieves to go out and steal electronics, steal things, bring them to the mafia dons, sell them, then go back out and steal more, come back, sell them. Eventually they start stealing welfare checks and social security checks from their neighbors and things like that. The mafia dons are taking them. This goes on for 6 months. And by the way, the first attempt at this was a fake outfit called Urban Research Associates. And people were in such desperate needs for jobs that they assumed that this was some kind of a job placement place. And so they went trying to find jobs. They couldn't get fences. So that's part of the reason why they went to the mafia angle. They ended up, after 6 months, they built criminal profiles with all of these guys, and they arrested like 120 people, most of them young, unemployed black men. Most of them, they were all convicted. Most of them took a plea bargain. So it's a really easy way to arrest somebody, get a conviction, and send them to jail or prison for a period of time. And so once this happens, law enforcement across the country wants to do this. The federal government thinks this is a great idea. They start funding the stings. Ford makes a FBI training video that gets dispersed to police departments. And I think by the end of the 1970s, there are like 4,000 people nationwide have been arrested in similar kind of operations. And then by the 80s, during the crack era, with the drug stings, you begin to get mass arrests in the thousands. And by then, talk about creating crime to fight crime, the Miami Police Department starts using cocaine that it seizes in drug raids and begins manufacturing crack in the county courthouse. So Miami police are manufacturing crack for undercover officers to go out, sell to people, sell to drug abusers, and then arrest them in these sting operations. And they're still a very kind of important part of how law enforcement's done today. It's a great way to arrest people.
Yeah, another sort of element, another instance of sort of policing in action, what it looks like on the ground. Talk about in Detroit, STRESS, mm-hmm. that program. What was STRESS in Detroit?
So STRESS was right before this program, and it was kind of the earlier iteration, again, acting on potential crime, trying to stop future criminals or potential criminals, and it involved a decoy squad, where basically another undercover thing. They had these squads all across the country where officers would dress up as old people, postmen. They'd wear costumes and try to provoke people into robbing them or attempting to rob them and then arresting them. STRESS was one of the most violent decoy squads. A lot of these tactical units, actually one started here in New York City, also led to a lot of deaths of unarmed citizens that were always rationalized as kind of the unfortunate consequence of doing police work in a hard neighborhood. But Strass was exceptional because I think they killed, the squad was responsible for the deaths of, I think, 19 or 20 Detroit citizens, and every single one of them but one were black. So this squad was essentially, and it's undercover work. And of course, if you know, people react differently to you if you're not in uniform. So there's some cases where there are like mistaken identities, and the police forget that they're not in their uniform, or I don't know, and they'll pull out a gun on somebody who they suspect doing something, and that person will respond by shooting them back or firing a bullet or hitting them because they don't realize that it's a police officer. So these kind of decoy scenarios led to a lot of fatalities on the streets of American cities, and I think, you know, it makes us rethink, you know, that the war on crime is not just a metaphor for something, but something that actually did involve these street battles between police squads and the citizens that they're targeting.
Yeah, and sort of the intensity of that combined with your analysis of the sort of self-fulfilling prophecy, mm-hmm. how this dynamic perpetuates itself, it makes it seem as if there's no way out, and sort of lurking in the background is just the fact of, like, you know, you have all these efforts and they're doing nothing to reduce the crime rate. If anything, they're raising it.
Mm-hmm.
But so your book, it covers a lot of ground. You know, you're starting with Kennedy and you're going into Reagan. But if you had pushed it into the 90s and after, you have had to deal with the fact that, you know, the seemingly unbreakable cycle, it breaks starting in the early 90s, right? That, I mean, maybe the crime statistics are wrong, but if they're right, then at least as I understand it, for the last 25 years or so, crime rates have been falling. So how what's your explanation for that? How does this, like, rupture happen? Which, to be fair, it's like a rupture mm-hmm. that happens outside the context of the book, but still seems important for understanding previous dynamics.
Mm-hmm. I think that crime is and is difficult to measure. I think that really the best measure is homicides or violent crime,
which have fallen by 50%, I think.
And a lot of the communities, you know, in some communities, crime that hasn't necessarily gone down, violent crime hasn't necessarily gone down. It's a problem that's still with us, and it's a problem that goes in waves. I mean, it's part of the question that's at the center of my next book, trying to understand and trying to historicize the violence that we see in the kind of urban violence and gang warfare that we see that is kind of, again, self-fulfilling prophecy and outcome of these things, and then what happens in the 90s. What we do know is that it's not directly related to incarceration. You know, the kind of use of incarceration as an effective crime deterrent has been, by some of the best social science research, essentially been squashed. And so there are a number of different theories as to why mm-hmm. it's gone down. But I think reading this recent Brennan Center study, in some places like Baltimore, Chicago, neighborhoods in Los Angeles, it hasn't. So
yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And given the sort of like that tracking of violence, right, where it's like mm-hmm. so, I mean, some areas are safer, some areas are, if anything, like more dangerous than ever, and the overall thrust of your book, I think if you're just coming in with like a vague sense of sort of like liberal lefty media talk today, you'd be like, oh yeah, Michelle Alexander, like this is a part of the new Jim Crow.
Mm-hmm.
But you say early on that you don't think that this fits into that category. Why not?
Well, I mean, people have said, oh, this is the academic version of the new Jim Crow, or this is like the historic, they've made comparisons because in a lot of ways our arguments are similar. I guess as a historian, and I don't even know to what extent Michelle Alexander would necessarily say this, I think the new Jim Crow is really important in terms of the fact that it's like it's a concept that we can grasp onto and we have a sense of what she's talking about when she says that, but I really want us to think about this as not being kind of just another extension of one racial regime, but something that is historically distinct in that it involves the criminalization of urban space and that involves the criminalization of social welfare programs, which is very specific to the late 20th century and the Johnson administration, and I think is what the kind of ever-growing carceral network is how we get mass incarceration, with the prison system being kind of the head of the the octopus of the carceral state, if you want to think of it that way.
And sort of maybe, I think, linked to this is thinking about how this fits into sort of historiography, how historians have been writing the history of the 20th century. In a way, I almost felt sometimes reading your book as if you were shocked at how much material there was, and sort of shocked that historians hadn't gotten to all this stuff already. Given, like, it's not true, like, I mean, there's, like, real archival research here, but a lot of it's, like, just go to a presidential archive and, like, look in it. Like, you're there already. If you just went to a different box, you'd be able to see, like, all the stories that were in here. And I wondered if in the book there isn't, is there, like, a critique of sort of, you could call it, like, the unbearable whiteness of American historiography? And specifically, you know, think about, like, the Great Society. You say, like, you know, we have, like, endless volumes on, like, the War on Poverty, on LBJ. We, you know, we could just, like, fill, like, library after library with that stuff. And yet somehow nobody links up this other question. Like, how does that, I don't want to put words in your mouth. Like, what's, what are you thinking about?
Well, I think, so as I, when I started this project, I knew, I was trained, I came to this project trained in kind of like Black studies as an African Americanist, and I didn't, came to it doing the history of Black power and organizational history, and doing the history of Black power led me to these kind of like larger structural questions about, well, what, because we didn't have a sense from, you know, the, in within African American studies, we had all these wonderful organizational histories. We didn't really know, well, how did the federal government respond to the civil rights movement? How did, even when racism is no longer acceptable, how does race fit into federal policies? Because obviously we're still dealing with inequality. It's not as if the civil rights movement solved everything. So I was trying to kind of think about why federal policy matters for African Americanists, but also like how racism and the politics of crime control shaped 20th century history, as you said, in ways that historians hadn't seen. I was actually also shocked that even some of the more recent books by very prominent historians on the War on Poverty don't mention Johnson's crime control policy, which are, I mean, for the administration, this, I mean, they devoted a lot of energy and cared very much about this crime control program because Johnson was aware, I am starting the national law enforcement program. I need to make sure that it's really good. He funded all kinds of studies, had conferences, discussions with the Crime Commission, you know, spent 3 years writing the legislation that eventually started it. And I think that people don't, I mean, it goes back to the liberal critique, you know, people kind of herald Johnson and they see him in one way and they romanticize him. And, you know, they don't really want to deal with some of maybe his bad choices, perhaps especially, you know, after Reagan.
But they will when it's Vietnam.
Yeah.
Right? Like, it's almost as if, like, they have that narrative of the tragedy of Lyndon Johnson, and they don't want to do anything that upsets it.
Yeah, I mean, maybe in terms of his domestic policy, it has to do with, the rightward shift of our country. I mean, the fact that Nixon's domestic policies, in many respects, are far to the left of Obama. We've really, really shifted, and I think that there's a kind of fond memory for that era in the 1960s. But as a historian, you know, I try to celebrate Johnson by telling the story as I interpret it and by trying to be kind of truthful to what his legacies are and what maybe some of the unintended consequences of his ideas of how to improve America were.
And if you guys want to know the prominent liberal historians who she's calling out in the book, but not by name, footnotes, page 343, footnote 2, check it out. But thinking, though,
it's
about
like a 300-page book on the War on Poverty and, like, mentioned maybe a sentence in the book.
Yeah. And so I think this is tied up with maybe a bigger problem, too. It's hard to talk about this without getting really vague, but I think it's, like, embedded in what you were just saying. Do you think U.S. historians, maybe 20th century U.S. historians, I'll phrase the question by way, it's like saying, one thing I really like about the book is that you have a very clear conception of what power is. You have the sense of, like, where to look for it, how it's exercised, and the work that it does. And sometimes it's not the sense of, like, oh, there's this all-powerful force behind the curtain. In fact, no, when you look at the history of it, you can see how often people's plans blow up in their face. So you have a sense of both, like, the real effect that people with power can have and the real limitations of that. Do you think that U.S. historians, generally, have we done a good job of thinking about how power works in the 20th century?
I think we're all still trying to figure it out. I think that I think that part of the limitation is that so much of what dominates the historiography of the 20th century has significant blind spots in terms of class, in terms of race, in terms of gender. And, you know, I have blind spots too. Everybody has blind spots. But if I think that because it's so central to U.S. political and social development, that if you, and economic development, that if you're not attuned to those things and conscious of those things, your conception and your interpretation of how power is operating is going to be extremely limited.
And it's not a story the LBJ archives want to tell.
Right. Exactly. Exactly.
And so, but thinking about, I want to open this up to questions soon, but a few questions, two questions from the audience soon, but a few things before I do that. Obviously, sort of the present, concerns about what's going on in the present, contemporary issues, like they run through the book from, mm-hmm. I mean, I should have known this before. I had a PhD in U.S. history and I didn't. It's shocking to see, like, I mean, it's, obviously there are like these waves of riots that are erupting in the United States mm-hmm. in the 60s, but you see again and again in the book that they're, it seems like almost always caused by cops shooting mm-hmm. a black kid, mm-hmm. some like young black guy, and it just mm-hmm. happens again and again.
Mm-hmm.
But if you were thinking about sort of the history since this book specifically, so from the 90s to the present, if you were writing that chapter that took the history in here up to 2016, what do you think the main themes of that chapter would be?
Okay, so from 90 to 2016, what would the main themes be?
That's another book in its own.
That
right,
is another. I mean, that's, yeah. I mean, I think part of what I want to take up in the next book is the way that mass incarceration itself is deeply implicated in the informal economies on the streets of many American cities, and the ways in which, because through that, correction officers and state forces are also involved in those economies. Again, it's kind of the self-fulfilling prophecy, what we see with recidivism and all these other things. I would think that we need to center what goes on in the prison systems and prison itself, the sheer kind of new organizing opportunities, possibilities that being mass incarcerated opens to low-income men who are disproportionately incarcerated. I think that we need to, and that maybe in some ways gets to that answer about the question of what kind of happens in the 90s in terms of our perception of crime and things like that. So I think we need to actually begin to deal with the kind of larger impact, the way that mass incarceration, the impact in the communities where literally, you know, the million-dollar blocks, where entire blocks are basically removed and put in prison. Like, what is the impact of that? How does that shape social interactions? How does that shape economies? How does that shape the communities where the prisons are? Things like that. And I think that the prison itself has been left out of many of our stories, even though we have great sociological research on and political science research on, like, you know, what constitutes the prison and you know, like, who's incarcerated, but we haven't really kind of thought about them in a larger milieu.
Mm-hmm. I started reading this book on the day that Barack Obama spoke at the eulogy in Dallas for the five police officers who had been shot. And in that eulogy, he said, and this, I'm cutting out some bits from a quote, he said, "We allow poverty to fester so that entire neighborhoods offer no prospect for gainful employment.
Mm-hmm.
And then we tell the police, you're a social worker, you're the parent, you're the teacher, you're the drug counselor. And then we feign surprise when periodically the tensions boil over. We know these things to be true." Do you think he's right?
Well, that's kind of the story of the Johnson administration in some ways. Mm-hmm. You know, it's kind of a metaphor for that. And yeah, I mean, as long as the socioeconomic root problems are not addressed in a systematic, structural way, these problems are going to continue.
Mm-hmm. You talked about, I think you alluded to this earlier, but so much of the book is about the sort of bipartisan creation of the carceral
mm-hmm.
state. And I think you alluded to the prospect of a bipartisan decarceration
right
now. Like, so can you talk about how that might play out and how much faith you have in that outcome?
Yeah, I mean, there's promise in legislation in front of Congress right now. I think that, and I don't know, I'm still trying to make sense of everything that's happened in the past few weeks, in the past month. But you know, the outcome of the election, I think, is going to determine it, especially with Trump now running as, like, the law and order, make America safe again, candidate. that has very grave implications for this kind of momentum. But yeah, I mean, you have everybody from Newt Gingrich and Van Jones partnering together on the smart on crime stuff, or right on crime stuff, and you know, there is kind of this new commitment to, because incarceration has become such a fiscal drain on states. States like California, Michigan, Georgia spend more money incarcerating kids than on educating kids, and I think we just can't afford the sheer cost of being the world's largest incarcerator. So there's that, the kind of fiscal aspect of it. What I'm very concerned about is if we do begin to incarcerate, and some states like California have begun to kind of roll back the three strikes laws and let people out for early release, especially, you know, the kind of first generation, the first mass incarceration generation in my period, the guys who were incarcerated in the 70s, you know, under these kind of like terms of potential delinquency and things like that. They're, you know, old now, and they're having health problems, and that again is you know, then they should be released. They were sentenced under very, very draconian guidelines that have since been reversed by many states. So there are kind of those battles. The question is, what's going to happen after release? The question, I think, the new horizon really is reentry, and I'm very, very concerned about the kind of direction that reentry has taken, which we could get into during questions if you want.
Yeah, let's take it. I've hogged the floor enough. Who has questions?
Thanks, yeah. So you mentioned that criminalization of urban spaces is something that you really wanted to emphasize. And I've been just finished reading The Power Broker, and I've been thinking about like highways and suburbanization. And I guess like that makes me wonder, you know, is there... You know, should we also be thinking about FDR, Truman, Eisenhower as like people coming before Kennedy, Johnson, who are contributing to a removal of middle class and removal of white people from urban spaces? And I guess like the question that phenomenon leaves me, similar to like the questions you were asking yourself about Johnson, like why did we do that? Like were we what did they think they were going to leave the cities with?
So, I mean, it's part of the outcome, I think, of why, what I argue in the book, why in 1961, even though you're right, I mean, at that moment when that kind of post-war moment, that prosperous moment, we do have this kind of... new investments in public works and things like that, and also new investments and a new kind of rise of an expansion of law enforcement that's going on at the state and local level. In 61, when Kennedy kind of launches the first federal intervention in low-income urban areas that's explicitly targeting Black Americans, it's largely in response to exactly the transformations that you're talking about. So the Great Migration, where cities like DC is just become majority Black, Cleveland, Detroit are about a third Black, and policymakers become obsessed with this concept, again, social science concept of social dynamite, that like there are all these Black youth, the middle class have left, white people are leaving, the tax base is declining, and cities are increasingly becoming populated with Black youth with no job prospects. And unless the state steps in to do something, this population is going to explode. So we get the juvenile delinquency programs of the Kennedy administration that is the basis for the war on poverty, and then Johnson goes and expands these programs. So the federal government, and sure enough, even though the delinquency programs are meant to stop the social dynamite from exploding, 3 years later that we get the kind of beginnings of the wave of urban unrest throughout every summer of Johnson's presidency, beginning with Harlem in 64. So all of these policies, it is kind of that, like, okay, so now we've gotten to the point where state and local governments can't handle this problem, and we have to step in or else the nation is going, our cities are going to explode.
Lois?
So Muslim Leader has written a little bit about this moment, and her argument is not that liberals sort of skew to their own racism, but more that conservatives were constructing a rhetoric that they took protest and reframed it as crime, and that Johnson's advisor said, hey, we can't let them rest on this crime thing.
would not have been able to write this book in many respects if it wasn't for Veshla kind of going through the LEAA documents and laying the groundwork on it. She is, I think I mentioned her earlier, she's one of the political scientists who actually put race front and center in terms of her understanding the development of the carceral state. And we've talked, Veshla and I have talked about this some. But I don't think, again, it's that political science. This is in response to Goldwater's campaign. And I think it is to a certain extent, but I also think that starting the National Crime Control Program was really important to Johnson in its own right. And he saw it as kind of, and the merger of the war on poverty, the programs of the war on poverty, the programs of the war on crime, as a really kind of formidable urban policy that was outside of the direct electoral realm and was really about his kind of his idea and what he, you know, his idea of the Great Society and what he wanted his program, his legacy to be, and the U.S. that he wanted to help create.
Go back there.
Hi. Last year, Naomi Murakawa came out with a book called First Civil Right, and I was thinking a lot about it as I was reading the book, and it raised some questions I wanted to ask you. I felt way more optimistic reading your book than I did reading Murakawa's book, because she sort of takes skews closer to the idea that after the end of segregation, you have procedural neutrality in like with regards to race in the context of massive inequality, and that unless you can have racially targeted policies, you'll never be able to change anything. As opposed to the view that I think, and that, correct me if I'm wrong, that kind of comes through in your book, which is even in the absence of explicitly racial, we term the legislation, it's still possible to alleviate some of the problems. And I think that also ties into the sort of, there's like an addendum to the question, and this is something that I feel like has been rattling around a little bit in terms of histories of mass incarceration and also race in general in the United States, about the immutability of white supremacy as a factor in American history. And so you have, I don't know, maybe right, I don't want to mischaracterize, but writers like Ta-Nehisi Coates seems to take the idea that this is something that you can't escape from history, you can't escape from this legacy, and it will continue to prevent reforms and all, or someone more, I can't think of someone right off the top of my head who kind of rebuts Coates in that way. But I was curious about where you sort of saw your work fitting into that kind of debate.
I think that, you know, Coates is kind of depressing in that sense. I mean, I'm much more optimistic that we can change. I think that we still have a long way to go. I think that, again, and I feel like, you know, I say this again and again, and I've said this many times tonight, and it is that kind of impossible goal. But if we really are willing to, and we've heard this a lot, but come to, like, get past the things, the artificial things that divide us, and come together and really commit to transforming things and maybe redistributing things to a certain extent, because that might be necessary to do that. I do believe that could be possible. I hope it's possible in our lifetime. I think, you know, it's something that I, and I'm sure many people in this room, are committed to working towards. But maybe part of that would be to address the ways in which, you know, because as I said, racism is so central to those divisions, and classism. But maybe part of that does involve, as Moynihan said, I mean, his initial kind of purpose in writing the Moynihan Report, the Negro Family, was to inspire or to lobby federal policymakers to enact policies that specifically targeted black men. And what ends up happening is that we get these crime control policies, not these, you know, this job, these employment opportunities and things like that Moynihan wanted, but these crime control policies that target black men. And I think that we have to deal with the real consequences of some of the historical decisions we've made and the ways that those policies and that the past plays out in the lives, not just in African Americans, but in the lives of other marginalized and isolated groups. So, but I'd like to think that I'm optimistic that things can that things can and will change. I'd like to make a better world for future generations. And again, to live up to, I think live up to the founding principles of this country, which we have yet to do.
So I'm going to ask a student a question one of my high school students
okay.
asked me. So she came to me having read Coates and read Michelle
okay.
Alexander and very, cynical, like this is just all the same
mm-hmm.
racist crap that I've experienced my parents and my grandparents. And so I gave her your book. And she read it and understood most of it. And ended up writing a paper arguing that no, this is a unique phenomenon where there might have been some well-intentioned things that went poorly. And she comes to me now, great, I understand this. What am I supposed to do with this?
So I think, and this is what I tell my students, and I think we're beginning to see this. That's what this moment is all about. I mean, we've got to go back to our forebears, and we've got, it's not as if we, we can sit here and we can say these things, or we can ask policymakers and people in power to do things, but it takes actually getting out there and demanding, it takes protests, it takes getting out there on the street and actually doing it, because history shows us that, this change doesn't happen out of the goodness of people's heart. It's the outcome of proacted protest and organizing people and things like that. So that's one thing that they can do. And to vote for elected officials that you feel like actually represent your values. There's something else too, and I'm sure it'll come back to me. But I'm the gin gimlet is beginning to.
Anything else? All right, so we can continue the conversation.
Please, yes.
But, so I'm sure, we've come to our time, and I'm sure everyone wants to get home to see if Eric Trump plagiarizes Sasha or Malia.
Oh,
but.
Winery guy. I really want to hear from the head of Trump winery.
Wait, he's speaking tonight, too?
I believe so.
Oh, my yeah. God.
You guys passed up a meal ticket tonight. It was a real trip. But the conversation, I think there's still some liquor left, so we can keep the conversation going for a little while. But in case you're leaving now, I just wanted everyone an opportunity to give you a take this opportunity to thank Elizabeth for coming out and having us.
Thank you.